Chapter 31. Planet Sallust. Day 1 of the Siege of the New Surtur.
Namir had half a dozen search and rescue squads ready to go. It wasn't the mix he might have wanted. Too few medics and engineers, too many demolition specialists. But all were combat ready, and they could travel fast. The rest of the company would stay behind at the processing facility and fortify for an attack. Because an attack had to be coming, and Twilight Company had nowhere to run. He signaled the first wave to head out. Scouts riding speeder bikes pillaged from the facility hangar, shot down the mountain slope, angling toward the plume of black smoke rising into the sky. The rest of the squads would need to reach the Thunderstrike, whatever was left of the Thunderstrike, on foot. He gave the nod to Carver, who began speaking into his link. Boots struck obsidian and stone, and team leader shouted marching orders. Namir adjusted his helmet and breath mask, cinched his rifle strap, and started to follow when a voice cut in over the comm.
"They're dead, and we need you here. Stop this,"
Chayla said. Namir didn't answer. Instead, he joined the soldiers scrabbling down the rock toward their lost ship. He tried to remember how many people had been aboard the Thunderstrike. More than 30 permanent crew members, any company members not cleared for ground combat, and injured soldiers unfit for duty. How many were there? Von Geis would know. But he'd stayed aboard the Thunderstrike too. Damn it all. The trek to the transport was brutal. An early fall scraped Namir's hands raw as he slid down a bank of gravel. Reports from the scouts urged him forward, kept him moving despite the rough terrain. The ship was still partly intact, the scout said. The reactor hadn't detonated on impact. There might still be survivors. When the vessel came into view, however, it was hard to maintain hope. The Thunderstrike was only intact in that it hadn't shattered altogether. Even from far up the mountain, even through the smoke, Namir could see a massive breach through the center of the vessel. If it had tried to rise into the air, it would have fallen in two. Shortly thereafter, the scouts reported Imperial airspeeders en route. If there was any chance of rescuing the living, it had to be done before bombing runs reduced the wreckage to a crater full of scorched metal. Onward. Namir listened to the first wave of search and rescue teams call out every victory and loss. They tore aside doors and found members of the bridge crew trapped under consoles, hurt but alive. They found the broken parts of M2-M5 scattered across the medbay. The sardonic droid's final act had been to try to protect the wounded. By the time Namir arrived on the scene, Von Geis, his face stained with blood as red as a warning light, had begun triage, counting the dead, sending the worst casualties toward the processing facility on speeder bikes, ordering the rest to rejoin Twilight on foot. Namir was glad to defer to the old medic's expertise. He kept the conversation brief as they sheltered beneath a hull fragment and listened to blaster cannons pelt the stone around them. "How many unaccounted for?" Namir asked.
"Another 20, perhaps," Von Guy said. "We can't reach the lower decks."
"Keep trying," Namir said. "But if we start losing our line of retreat, we all pull out together." Von Geis nodded. He'd been with Twilight a long time, and he knew when a patient was too far gone to save. As the afternoon wore on, the squads formed a chain between the shipwreck and the processing facility. Namir would escort a handful of limping and bruised crew members 100 meters up the mountain slope and hand them over to the next squad, assuring them that shelter wasn't far. Zab's team built a makeshift sniper's nest above the wreckage to provide cover while others salvaged canisters of liquid Bacta and medical devices. As night fell, Namir bent his knees as Commander Tona leaned heavily on his shoulders, clasped the tatters of his glove to the larger man's breath mask as the Thunderstrike skipper tried to howl in pain. Too many enemies too close, Namir told him. We can't give away our position. Heavier bombers finally arrived shortly after dark, smashing fresh holes in the thunderstrike and sending shards of metal and bone flying. Fewer casualties emerged from hiding, even as Imperial ground troops appeared on the horizon and their scouting parties delivered constant volleys of blaster bolts. Namir didn't remember sending the order to withdraw, though he knew he must have done so. His mouth tasted like ash, and his lips were cracked as he began his final march back. He'd stopped sweating hours before, and his legs ached with every step up the slope. He wondered for only an instant about the situation back at the processing facility, then forced that question from his mind. Survive first, he told himself. Then find a way to save Twilight. Of the soldiers who'd joined the rescue parties, five were unaccounted for when Namir stumbled back into the processing facility, winding his way through a maze of barricades improvised from industrial equipment. If they're not back in an hour, assume they're dead, he told Twitch, who stood guard at the innermost sentry post. If they come in later, we can believe in miracles. He felt simultaneously hollow and heavy, a shell of a body wearing skin of lead. Men and women hurried to his side as he walked under dim yellow lighting through the main access corridor. None brought him water or food or a change of gloves. Instead, they burdened him with reports and updates about Apylonus Promise, which appeared to have fled Sallust intact. A team was attempting to make contact and determine the gunship's position. They told him about Imperial infantry forces circling the base of the mountain and slowly closing the noose. They guessed at the likelihood of repairing the Thunderstrike, not inconceivable with the proper resources, but impossible under fire. Or what could be stripped and salvaged from it instead? Namir tried to absorb it all, comprehend the reports and provide direction when required. When the last of the urgent demands on him had been addressed, he pulled aside one of the Haidoral recruits whose name he couldn't recall. What do you need, Captain? The man asked. Namir didn't correct him. I want to see the field hospital, he said. I want water, and I want to meet with Governor Chalice. After he'd drunk his fill, after he'd stilled his stomach after breathing in the vile odors of the aid station, he found Chalice in the administrator's office. The vast space had been hastily ransacked, likely by the administrator when Twilight had first arrived, and niches in the wall that might once have held plaques or awards were now empty. An upholstered couch was scorched on one end, and beside it a stack of boxes held facility records. Chalice sat at a desk apparently carved from a single piece of mountain stone, gripping the edge of the rock with her fingers as if she expected to crush it into dust. Someone planned this, she said, voice taut and bitter. She didn't bother to ask Namir about the rescue operation. The moment we landed, they were preparing to cut off our escape. And whose fault is that? Namir wanted to ask. But he didn't want to know the answer. It hardly mattered now. So what comes next? He asked instead. Our enemy, for the sake of convenience, will presume its prelate Verge brings reinforcements to annihilate us. I'd expect a Star Destroyer in system shortly. Just one should be enough. One would have been enough for Hoth, too. He dropped himself on the couch. How fast do those things move? Faster than a stripped-down Rebel Corvette past its prime. I wouldn't give us more than a day or two at most. He wanted to drift off, stop thinking for a moment. He made himself speak. Then we get off the planet first somehow. Head farther into the Outer Rim. Lick our wounds. What? Chalice's tone was suddenly sharp. Namir straightened in his seat. They know, he said, frustration giving him strength again. The prelate figured out the plan. You said over and over that if that happened, No one knows what we're doing, she said. She started to continue, then began to cough, chest heaving and head bent forward. Namir wanted to avert his eyes, but Chalice never turned from him, as if trying to hold him in place until she could resume. When the fit subsided, she spoke slowly and hoarsely. Even if the prelate saw some pattern, she said, that doesn't mean he knows our goals. We can adjust. We can survive one loss. The window of opportunity is still open. Namir watched her. Her hand still clutched the stone of the table. Unless, she added, and smiled a forced, deathly smile, you want to announce to the company that we're giving up. Namir began to laugh. He couldn't have justified why. It wasn't a raucous or a joyous sound, and he tasted ash rising from his lungs, gritty on his lips. Chalice maintained her frozen rictus, and finally he shook his head. You're the one who likes giving speeches, he said. If it comes to that, maybe you should tell them yourself. They watched each other. Eventually, Chalice's smile faded. She stood from the desk and walked to a table in the corner of the office where a tin pitcher sat. She lifted it, glanced about, then shrugged, and brought the pitcher to the couch. Namir took it and drank gratefully. The lukewarm water tasted bitter. It reminded him of the well water of Crucible. As I see it, we have two challenges ahead. First, we need to survive the coming siege, and if we can't avoid it, whatever blow Verge's reinforcements deliver. Second, we need a way off Sullust. I suggest, and I'm open to alternatives, that you take care of the former. Devise a way for us not to die. I'll get to work on the latter. She still stood over him above the couch. Namir drew himself upright and set the pitcher on the desk. Fair enough, he said. Does that mean you have a plan? I will, Chayla said curtly, and it sounded like an oath. The company worked through the night, readying the facility for attack. Namir toured the processing center, walked among the ranks, offered his strength or advice where he could be useful, and stepped back when he was unwanted. On the lower levels, the engineers scrambled to undo the adjustments they'd made to the magma extractors. Flooding the facility was no longer one of Twilight's short-term objectives, but the molten rock might prove integral to the facility's defense. If the Empire tried to imitate Twilight's previous strategy of sending in burrowing vehicles below the compound, the attackers would find Twilight ready to rechannel the magma flow. It was the sort of dirty trick that won wars. Unpredictable, unfair, and deadly. Namir smiled grimly when Vifra, Twilight's new head of engineering since M2M5's destruction, described what she had in mind. And he challenged her to take it a step farther. Were you here for the fighting on Kartow? He asked. Vifra flinched and glanced toward her comrades as they dismantled a control terminal. She seemed to be seeking support. I really just got here, she said. I joined 6 months ago off for Saget. Namir had probably been there for her recruitment, he realized. But she was an engineer, and so he'd never trained her, never called her fresh meat. She must have been blasted good to rise so swiftly through the ranks, even considering the company's rapid attrition. He made a note to get to know her. Doesn't matter, he said. Keep us alive, and I'll tell you about Kartow after. When Namir returned to the upper floors, the distant thunder of Imperial bombs made the facility sound as if it were weathering a storm. On a lookout post above the main wall, he could see flashes all about the peak of the mountain, see streaks of light in the sky where the bombers passed. The Empire wasn't attempting to destroy the facility. It still wanted to preserve the infrastructure. but it was doing all it could to contain Twilight Company. Still, Namir thought that meant more time to prepare. The barricade mazes at the facility entrances had been transformed over the past few hours, reorganized to funnel enemies into kill zones and allow snipers a line on attackers. The mazes were works of art. A junkyard of sabotaged load lifters and spare parts and toppled beverage dispensers. But Namir ordered most of the soldiers constructing them to another task. "If the enemy gets this close," he told one group, "we're bound to lose anyway. I want squads around the perimeter in positions they can hold. Keep the Empire down the slope. Make them fight for every meter they climb." That meant, of course, digging trenches and assembling artillery pieces near the sites of the bombings, hoping dust and night and caution gave enough cover for safety. Namir didn't ask for volunteers or offer the troops a chance to back out. He saw that they were afraid. The young and old, veterans and fresh meat. Yet the job had to be done, and they went without complaint. He felt a mixture of pride and guilt as he continued his tour. He saw the soldiers put their losses, the deaths of their colleagues and the destruction of their vessel, to one side, determined to do their part in an impossible situation. If they survived, there would be trauma and grief. Some of them would break. They'd put themselves in the line of fire, request non-combat duties, or walk away on a mission and never return. Yet he trusted all of them to hold together until the battle was over. He'd led them to Sallust with a promise to strike against the Empire. He was responsible for their fate. But if they could hold together, he could too. A gray dawn arrived, and Namir met briefly with the squad leaders and senior staff, sketching a plan of battle for the coming siege. Hober and Von Geis had counted the dead and wounded, quantified the company's capabilities as well as they could. It hardly seemed to matter in the face of a planet's worth of attackers, but Namir and Carver and Gadrin and Mazoon and the others pretended the battle was winnable anyway. "Should Chalus be present?" Von Geis asked abruptly. He'd cleaned the blood from his face and wrapped white gauze at an angle over his forehead and left eye. The others looked to Namir, who shook his head. "If she had a plan ready, she would be here," he said. "Let her work." He'd seen bitterness and fury in her during their meeting, but not the despair he'd witnessed on Ankurl. He trusted she would do what she could. He had no choice but to believe she would hold together, too. Namir slept on the floor of one of the upper-level offices, leaving instructions with Hober to wake him if anything happened. No more than 2 hours passed before Runner arrived with a tray of food and the news that Chalus wanted to see him. He ate hastily. Pooled in the tray's compartments was some sort of noodle soup, apparently scrounged from a worker's locker, and tried to gauge his strength. The rest had boosted his energy levels, and the food would do so as well, but the boost would fade fast, and his legs were still sore and throbbing from marching to and from the Thunderstrike. He also hoped to see combat. At least adrenaline might carry him through the day. Chalus had rearranged the administration office, moving the couch and boxes to one side and tiling the floor with maps of the mountain and its vicinity. In one of the niches now rested a bronze bust of a stern-looking man. Namir didn't have time to examine it before Chalus picked her way across the floor to his side. "I want to go to Pinyamba," she said. Namir frowned, tried to place the name. All Sallustan names sounded the same, and cursed his sluggish mind. Finally, he found what he sought. City at the base of the mountain? Chalus didn't correct him, so he'd assumed he'd guessed correctly. What for? "We know there was a resistance on this planet," Chalus said. That was true. The files aboard the Thunderstrike had indicated as much. though Alliance High Command didn't know or didn't care to share more than the bare bones. Luko's records show they attacked this facility recently and are active in the city. Luko, you on a first-name basis with the ex-administrator here? Namir asked, glancing toward the box of records again. Chayla seemed inured to the joke. I've had time on my hands. We can't maintain a channel to the Promise for more than a minute without being jammed, which makes formulating an extraction plan difficult. Not that the Promise has room to take us aboard, but we'll need a defense when we manage to get off-world. I get it, Namir said. What do you think the Resistance can do for us? Just about anything would help. Here, she did smile, a bitter, nasty twitch of her lips. I'm not expecting a starship, but even information would be an asset. Fine. Pick a squad, grab any vehicle in the hangar, but be prepared to slip through the perimeter on foot.
I'd advise you to come along, Chayla said.
All you can do here is wait, and if we do locate anyone, you might want a word with our potential reinforcements. Namir grimaced. He didn't like the thought of leaving. You might be overestimating the strength of the Resistance. If we haven't heard from them by now, Chayla stepped to the door and looked over her shoulder at Namir. You can't win this battle, she said. Our only hope is an exit strategy. Take whatever chance you can get. It was a blunt argument, but she wasn't wrong. Together with the three surviving members of Twitch's squad, Namir and Chayla's climbed into a boxy Imperial troop transport that hummed softly out of the hangar and toward the facility's main entrance. It was one of a handful of vehicles Twilight had made operational since the Thunderstrike's crash. It nearly ran over Roach as she hurried to wave it down and pulled herself up and through the hatch. Gadrin sent me, she told Namir, squeezing onto the bench beside him. He frowned. That leaves Gadrin with what, just Brand? Roach shrugged. Said you needed protection. She wasn't wearing her helmet. Namir noticed a patch of her scalp was bare, as if the hair had been burned or cut away to treat a wound. All right, Namir said. Another set of eyes could be useful, and Roach was skinny and quick, useful on the stealth mission. She nodded firmly, adjusted her comlink in one ear, and retrieved a second earpiece from her pocket. She inserted it deftly, and a moment later, Namir could hear the muffled, tinny sounds of music accompanying the transport's voyage down the mountain. Toward the base of the mountain, they abandoned the vehicle and changed into ill-fitting civilian clothing. Whatever garments the workers at the processing facility had left behind during the evacuation. They stashed their rifles with the troop transport, switching to knives and snub pistols small enough to conceal in boots and under vests. Comlinks were deactivated and stowed in pockets. Any close inspection would give Namir and the others away, but from a distance they might pass as Pinyumba locals. First, however, they had to reach Pinyumba. It was dusk when they began creeping down the slope, half squatting and half crawling as the terrain permitted. The Empire's perimeter was intended to stop infantry units and speeders, not catch lone travelers, but scouting a path was neither swift nor safe. Twice, Namir came within a stone's throw of a stormtrooper patrol and had to wait for the enemy to move on. The rebels scattered and regrouped over and over. Apart, they would draw less attention, but they were vulnerable alone. Roach stayed at Namir's side more often than not. He wondered if Gadrin had instructed her to do so, or if she decided to play bodyguard on her own. Once they were through the blockade, reaching the city was comparatively easy. Namir saw no civilian vehicles descending into the underground through the transport station, but a steady trickle of Imperial military vehicles and cargo carriers still flowed. In two teams of three, the rebels slipped aboard the carriers and squeezed between supply crates, letting the repulsor craft carry them onto lifts dropping below the planet's surface. Namir expected the air to grow thinner, to turn unbearably noxious in the bowels of Sallust, but instead, It seemed to grow pure, fresher even than the stale air of the Thunderstrike, reminding Namir of the dewy atmosphere of Hadoral Prime. He removed his breath mask with cautious excitement. Then the six travelers emerged furtively from the vehicles onto city streets, and Namir had his first glimpse of Pinyumba. The city sat within a great obsidian cavern, its roof dimly gleaming with refracted iridescence from tower lights. Its buildings were sleek, tapered, and curved instead of rigid, rising along turquoise waterways lined with footpaths and pedestrian bridges. The walkways, in turn, wove among rows of plants that glowed with phosphorescent bulbs and archways carved from the cavern stone. Namir caught himself staring in wonder. He wondered if his companions would scorn his reaction as naive, the ignorant amazement of a child from a backwater world. But Roach was grinning, unashamed, as she craned her neck and took in the cavern vista. That comforted Namir, even when Chalice murmured a warning to Roach and the girl's face became stony.
"Why is it quiet?"
Twitch asked through her teeth. Namir swore to himself and broke the city's spell. Twitch was right. There was no traffic in the streets except the receding transports, no civilians using the walkways or the bridges. The buildings were lit, certainly, but no sounds arose from inside. He felt suddenly exposed on the street, as if marked by a sniper. "The city is in lockdown," Chayla said.
"Typical procedure. It probably has been since we landed. Come on."
Chalice led the way into an alley, and they started their journey through Pinyumba, once again in twos and threes, once again sending scouts at every junction. They soon discovered that stormtrooper teams were stationed on every major throughway. Floating, bobbing cam droids combed the backways. But the Empire seemed to be patrolling as a show of force, not actively searching, and the squad had no difficulty remaining hidden. Here and there, Namir did spot a civilian, always moving briskly but not running, always with one hand holding up a data pad that doubtless served as authorization for travel. The squad's destination, Chalice had explained, was an old Resistance safe house, mentioned in Howell's files.
"We won't know if it's still active until we get there," she said, "but it's our best lead."
She navigated into a section of the city that appeared to have been erected in an earlier age. Among the metal structures were buildings made of stone, and the narrow streets were cracked and thick with yellow sulfur. The group descended a stairway into an alley beneath ground level and found a door built into the wall.
"An ice house,"
Chalice explained. Twitch began toying with the keypad. This would have been a wealthy district once. Primitive stored meat, milk, anything they wanted to keep cool here. The others looked puzzled, but Namir remembered the ice houses on his home world. He wondered if Chalice recalled such things from her childhood. She didn't glance at him once. Twitch made a triumphant sound. The door swung open, and they proceeded inside. The building's single room was devoid of life, furnished as a sparse apartment with a cot and stove and a portable sanitation station.
"Someone's been here,"
Twitch said, scuffing the dust on the floor. Namir agreed with the assessment, though it was hard to guess whether the safe house had last been used hours, days, or weeks before. A thorough search turned up scraps of food and medical supplies and nothing more, until Roach, guided by some instinct Namir couldn't guess at, fished a data pad from one of the sanitation station's filters. Chalice took possession of the prize, apparently untroubled by the bacterial slime clinging to the screen. After a few moments of study, she looked pleased.
"Someone was here,"
she echoed, tracking the coming and going of ships on Sallust. "Presumably gathering intelligence for an attack on a spaceport. I can use this." Namir held out a hand. Chalice passed him the pad and he tried to make sense of it. He skimmed through lists and monthly reports, unsure what he was looking for. He wondered briefly if he was reading the data correctly.
Surely there shouldn't have been such a massive difference between departures and arrivals. It seemed like for every 100 ships that reached the planet, 1,000 left. He asked Chalice about the discrepancy. She shrugged and reclaimed the datapad.
Manufacturing, she said. Sallust isn't Kuat, but it does handle small-scale production of starfighters and assault shuttles, nothing important.
Thousands of ships a year is small-scale production? He asked. His voice was low, but he felt the others glance his way. Chalice didn't even look up, her eyes on the pad again. She only grunted in acknowledgement, but he could hear the words she'd spoken to him once before.
You still think like a man from Crucible. You don't understand the scale of the enemy.
No one else seemed worried. Even Roach looked more concerned about Namir than any revelation about Sallust. Namir supposed Chalice was right, though the thought bothered him for reasons he couldn't place.
They decided to wait at the safe house for 3 hours to see if anyone from the Sallustan resistance appeared. After that, they would return to Twilight Company regardless of the outcome. Chalice sent 2 squad members to scout the Pinyumba spaceport, an underground facility connected to the surface by a kilometers-long shaft, while they waited.
I'd like to know our options, she said. That left Twitch, Roach, Chalice, and Namir in the cramped hideout. Chalice seemed content to study her data pad or stare at the wall, lost in thought.
Roach chattered at Twitch as they guarded the door, describing in intricate detail the items she'd purloined from the workers' lockers at the processing facility, and what she imagined those items said about the workers' personalities.
Namir relieved Roach after half an hour, partly for something to do and partly out of pity for Twitch.
When did she get so talkative?
He asked as quietly as he could, turning his snub pistol over in one hand.
She barely said a word in training.
Twitch shrugged. Namir had been expecting derision, but Twitch seemed to take Roach's attitude in stride.
After you left, I guess. She comes to the clubhouse, looks out at cards. Awful player. You get used to it.
Sorry I missed it, Namir murmured, only half-joking. Thoughts of Roach drew his mind back to Hadoral Prime. It had been, what, 2 months ago? He felt the gap in time vividly. On Hadoral, Howell had still been in charge. On Hadoral, he hadn't met Governor Chalice, and she hadn't yet fallen upon the company like a curse. He bitterly remembered the mission to her mansion, the opulence Gadrin and Brand and Charmer had bristled at. He stepped away from the door and waved Roach back into place. He spoke Chalice's name, drew her to the far corner of the room where she looked at him questioningly.
When were you on Sallust before?
He asked. She cocked her head and let the hand holding her datapad fall to her side.
Why do you ask?
The statue, he said. The piece in that administrator's office. It was yours.
I visited here several times during my apprenticeship under Count Vidian.
The words were flat and cold, a recitation of facts.
The bust was a gift to Administrator Luco Orne of Luco Orne in gratitude for his assistance implementing my designs. I imagine he saw fit to remove it after my betrayal. I put it back.
Nothing about the explanation seemed less than sensible. Still, Namir felt unsatisfied. The gears of his mind were scraping and grinding, failing to produce the thought he needed. He spoke, knowing it wasn't what he needed to say, knowing he sounded petulant.
What about Mardona 3? Or Nakadia? You visit there before too?
No, Chayla said, but I helped make them what they are now.
She smiled, and it looked like a snarl.
Is this a surprise? That I was involved in building what we're trying to dismantle? It's possible my connections to our targets are what allowed Prelate Vert to predict we'd hit Sallust. And that much is unfortunate.
but my intimate knowledge is why Howell wanted me in the first place. It's not... He had to stop himself from arguing. Again, she was right. She was always right. Chalice was smarter than him and sculpted conversations like clay. But somewhere in his head, something still bothered him. Whatever it was, it had nothing to do with Prelate Verge. How much of this plan, he began, fumbling with each word that emerged. And I mean all of it. From Ankurl to Kuat, how much of it is about you taking back what you gave the Empire? How much is this all just revenge for you not getting the respect you wanted? Chalice drew in a breath that sounded wet and rough. Namir could see the pulse in her neck. He kept talking, unsure he wanted to hear himself, let alone any answer. You keep telling me that I don't understand the Empire, that I don't understand the scope we're operating on. So fine, you're right. But is Kuat going to be any different? If we make it that far, if we live through everything and destroy the shipyards, does it even matter to the war? Because this is feeling more and more like a suicidal vendetta. The governor stood before Namir, her expression severe and unchanging, her chest heaving as she seemed to force down a fit of coughing by sheer willpower. It will matter, she said, as much as anything we could do would matter. As for my motives, those are my own and have no bearing on our success or failure. She seemed to flinch, and her voice became smaller as she added, I would have expected that question from a rebel. From you, I expected more. Namir had no answer to that. Chalice saved him from trying. Suddenly, she sounded confident again. As matter-of-fact as she became when briefing the senior staff, or as she'd been during her first meeting with Howell. It was a voice of impersonal charm, and Namir felt strangely hurt that she would use it on him. Besides, she said, I already have an idea of how to get us off Sallust intact. I'm not the sort of woman who would martyr herself. They were interrupted by the buzzing of their comlinks. Namir frowned, retrieved his from a pocket, and reset it in his ear. The others were doing the same. Get out! A voice whispered harshly. One of Twitch's scouts. They're right outside the safe house! Get out now! Twitch struck the door controls with a palm and moved outside, followed instantly by Roach. Namir glanced at Chalice and pulled her toward the alley. Crimson particle bolts struck the top of the alleyway, sending sparks and flecks of stone onto Namir's face. He tried to get a look at the attackers and couldn't. Instead, he saw Twitch and Roach on the stairway at the alley mouth, crouched low and firing pot shots with their snub pistols. Twitch was yelling something. All Namir heard was faster and some swearing. He dragged Chalice to the stairs, grabbed Roach's wrist, and put her hand on Chalice's arm. Head for shelter, he spat. We follow. Roach turned toward him, focused on the fight he wanted to say, as if to protest, but he cut her off. Twitch and I can cover you better. He assumed this much anyway. Roach might have become a chatty, reliable part of the team while he wasn't looking, but he was still a better shot than she. She took off with Chalice, and Namir took Roach's place, firing in the direction Twitch had targeted. On three? Namir said. Twitch nodded, and after another few shots, they ran, back the way they'd first come through the city. Across a street and down an alleyway, blaster bolts still streaming toward them, Namir spotted glimpses of white armor when he glanced back, but couldn't pinpoint the foe. He fired wildly, one-handed, in the hope of slowing pursuit. He didn't see where Roach or Chalice had gone. He swung around the wall of a stone building and nearly bowled into Twitch, who had stopped running and was looking toward the safe house. She shoved them aside roughly. Keep going! Catch up in a bit! Namir cursed and sputtered. What are you thinking? Twitch smiled her nasty little smile, the one Namir had seen on occasion in the clubhouse before she took a swing at a fellow soldier. My team, she said. Still back there.
Those two are dead, Namir snapped. You are your team.
Go to hell, Captain,
Twitch said, and charged past him back into the fray. He told himself he couldn't have stopped her. He felt for her. He wanted to chase her. But Roach and Chalice needed him just as much. Good luck, he muttered, and sprinted away from the stormtroopers.
When he tried to cross the next street, he didn't hear the grenade until his body was in the air, burning and aching in every muscle as if he'd slammed into a steel wall. Then he hit the road and blacked out.